Stay with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sulis. Interested in learning new skills online at a pace that suits you? Visit ecollege.ie to apply for one of our free online courses.
Good morning to you. Welcome to the programme. We've a busy morning ahead. Lots to come over the next 2 hours. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can text us 51551. Email todaycb@rte.ie or on Twitter. We are at Today with Claire. But first this morning, I'm joined in the studio by An Taoiseach Micheál Martin. And you're very welcome, Taoiseach. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
For being here. So you've 5 weeks left in the job now. That's where we're at.
As Taoiseach, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and you move then to Taoiseach. And for 2 years, over 2 years, you've been calling housing the single most urgent and important social issue facing our country. But you're leaving office now in December with that crisis, that emergency. It's nowhere near solved. And every single day we see lead stories in the newspapers about this. Like today, and you have young people in your family, you'll know how difficult it is to find somewhere to live. We have somebody now today paying $1,800 a month for a room in an apartment. And that's only till December, and that person is a student. It's a real mess, isn't it?
Well, first of all, we were never going to solve it in 2 years or in 2.5 years. And then we had COVID, which took out two lockdowns, took out a bit of construction. Then we had a war in Ukraine, which inflated prices for commodities and steel and undermined confidence in construction itself and in a lot of builders. But that said, we are making progress on this. And I think a lot of work has been done in the last 2.5 years in terms of laying the foundations for really turning the tide in terms of house construction.
Yeah, and we hear a lot about the statistics and the number of starts and so on. But
it's more than just statistics. It's actual houses that have been built. And this year we will exceed our target of 24,500. We'll be at 26,000 plus.
But we saw last week the target is wrong because it's based on 2016 figures, meaning we're going to have a shortfall even if those targets are hit.
But sorry, we want to exceed the targets anyway. I don't think that's a huge argument in itself, because the target was to get to 33,000. I've often said if we get to 35, 40,000 houses, that's where we should be going. The real issue is getting the capacity to build that many houses up, and also to build houses faster in a more rapid way. Delivery is the key here. The legislation has been passed. Over 16 housing acts have been passed. We have affordable housing schemes. We have the First Home Scheme, which enables people, helping them in terms of first-time buyers. We've had a record number of first-time buyers since about 2005 this year, with about 16,000 first-time buyers. But I take your point. It's not fast enough. And the fundamental issue facing us is that the younger generation in particular need access to housing. They need to be able to buy houses at an affordable price. They need to be able to rent houses at an affordable price. And we are determined to do that and to keep at this until we get it resolved.
You've mentioned all of the challenges, and there have been unprecedented challenges over the last 2 years, and everyone knows what they are. But when we hear, you know, this morning that another housing scheme isn't attractive to developers, and that's on the front page of a newspaper, that's a policy issue. That's putting in place strategies that just aren't working.
Well, that scheme, when it was announced, was denounced as being too attractive to developers at the time by opposition.
But the developers are now saying they can't get the money until...
I think government
has to hold firm, it's not working.
Well, I think we always have to be conscious of what gets said by one sector, but certainly we're consistently reviewing all schemes. If we can improve them, we will improve them. But it is interesting. That was my first thought this morning, because that originally we were told that was too attractive for developers. We were bailing out developers. We were underpinning developers with that Croí-Cónaithe scheme. Now the argument is it's not attractive enough. And on the meat of that, we will engage with the industry, I know the minister will, but the suggestion in the article seems to be because the payment comes too late. I mean, you can bank a payment that's going to come your way in respect of any particular unit. But it is a challenging environment in the private sector, because if you look at the housing market at the moment, the state is involved in most of the schemes right now. We're building a record number of social housing, and you know, Fianna Fáil always said we would do that and increase the social housing numbers, and we're going to do that. And the government broadly, the three parties in government, do see housing as the number one priority. So if we need to work on that scheme, we will. But there's a range of schemes that have been enacted, but the state's behind most of the state.
Yeah,
so there is an issue with the private sector, and I do believe the negative external environment has been a factor in undermining confidence in terms of private house construction.
And you make that interesting point about being criticised for bailing out developers, but maybe you're going to reach the point now where you're going to have to hold your nose and give tax breaks to developers, despite whatever criticism comes from the opposition, because we are losing our brilliant young people again who can't afford to live in our cities and work.
Well, I think that across Europe, an issue that's manifesting itself in terms of housing more generally. Even at the British Irish Council in Blackpool this week, you know, in England, Wales, Scotland, exactly the same issues they are facing as we are facing. And we are, I think one of the issues that we have to move more on is more rapid built housing, advanced manufacturing technology and construction, more off-site construction. I was in Fingal County Council 2 weeks ago. They're using advanced technology in terms of steel frames, for example, manufactured in Tipperary. It's enabling them to get housing constructed, certainly within a 12-month period and getting tenants in. So I think the industry and the sector has been too slow in respect of that, and government needs to give guarantees in terms of funding over the long term in respect of rapid build housing. We're already developing that in terms of the Ukrainian situation, but now it's going to be developed in terms of social housing also, in terms of rapid build houses.
Mm-hmm.
I think given the volume, given the issues facing us, the growing population, we are going over 5 million, we're going to have to build houses, far more rapidly than we are.
Yep.
And part of that will be the overhaul of the planning code.
But you didn't answer that question about whether you're going to now have to give more tax breaks to developers in order
to fix it. There's been a long-standing resistance to tax breaks in terms of construction, and that remains the position. That's why Croí Cónaithe came in. So there's very substantial grants and funding available to try and bridge the viability gap in urban apartment projects, particularly brownfield sites within cities. So the state has stepped in through Croí Cónaithe, which is the scheme that's been criticised this morning in the article. But again, as I say, if we have to fine-tune that scheme, we will to make it more attractive.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the other side of the tax coin in some respects. But the key point here is that I think there's a range of initiatives there now that should enable more projects to be built. So even in the student accommodation now, the state is looking at getting involved with the universities and the technological universities to underpin what they're saying is now a viability gap between what they can afford to build flat apartments, at student apartments, and what they can rent them out
and
in terms of affordable prices.
Who have homes now, we're entering into a period of interest rate rises. How worried are you that homeowners will be able to weather those hikes?
Well, I think it will be challenging, but we are emerging from a phase of historic low interest rates. Inflation is too high right now, so the monetary squeezing that's going on by the central banks was inevitable in terms of curbing inflation. It's the scale, or it's the pace and the level of that will be an issue that's open to debate. Europe, to be fair, has been slower than if you use that phrase, has been slower than say the Fed or others in respect of this issue, but we will keep that under review. Obviously there are concerns there, and that's why we introduced a very substantial budget and cost of living package to try and help people get mm-hmm. through what is a very difficult winter because of all the other issues.
Okay, and I want to talk to you about that in a moment, but you touched on Ukrainians there, and you talked about the modular homes now that will be built down the line for them. But the people coming from Ukraine, they're not even in the calculations, are they, for housing need, for long-term housing need? Why is that?
Because, first of all, the Housing for All was launched prior to a war on Ukraine. And fundamentally, our intervention in terms of Ukrainian refugees is in the context of that war. It's our expectation that the vast, vast majority of Ukrainians will go back to the Ukraine in the aftermath of the war. And that certainly is their intention. I mean, they don't necessarily want to be here. They're here because of a terrible, immoral war visited upon them by President Putin. And I think we did the right thing along with our European colleagues to stand up to Putin And that means standing up to his policy of weaponization of migration. Mm-hmm. In other words, terrorizing the civilian population. So they have to flee Ukraine. And he wants that to happen. He wants to disrupt Europe. Weaponization of food and weaponization of energy.
But we have no idea how long this situation is going to last. And there has been criticism around the lack of planning when it comes to looking after Ukrainian refugees. There was a meeting, you're probably aware, in Braithwaite in Mayo on Friday night. It was covered on Katie Hannan's programme on Saturday. 600,000 or 700,000 Ukrainian people and other displaced people in that very small area. And the community have questions around what's going to happen to our GP services, what's going to happen with our schools, what's going to happen with our hospitals. And they say there is no engagement, there are no answers.
Well, the United Nations estimate anything up to 14 million displaced within Ukraine, both 7 million displaced across Europe and 7 million within Ukraine itself. That is the scale. This is the worst humanitarian crisis on the continent.
That's fine. I think people people accept that, but people don't, or they want to know what the plan is.
If we accept it, then we have to rely. Yeah, when there is a plan, but the bottom line, this has all come within about 9 months, mm-hmm. less than 9 months, sorry. So we have to keep things in perspective as well. I think it's an extraordinary response by Ireland. I would take a different perspective on this. In terms of up to 63,000 Ukrainians have come into the country. About 46,000 have been housed by the state and the people. There are about 17,000 in direct provision or in international protection who have come into the country, compared to maybe 7,500 last year. So these are extraordinary numbers, unprecedented in terms of anything we've experienced in our past. That is the context. And of course, it's not going to be simple or easy to respond across the range. But I think our services have responded. That is my experience on the ground in terms of education and teachers and so on, notwithstanding the challenges. There are some areas who've taken an extra burden and the schools there are stretched.
Okay, so I just wonder why 180 people felt the need to leave their house on Friday night to go and have a meeting to say, we need answers here. I mean, are you going to say to that community today, we will engage with you?
Yes, of course we will engage with communities up and down the country in respect of this. And we will continue to engage with people. We appreciate the efforts that people are making in communities all over the country. It's been very positive. And to that end, we've allocated additional funds to communities. And we believe also that communities that have a higher burden because perhaps the availability of accommodation facilitated that we would support those communities in other ways then in terms of their cultural sporting infrastructure in that community. That in other words, that in acknowledgement and in recognition of the efforts they have made, that we would allocate additional resources in recognition of that.
How will that happen? I mean, that sounds like a new scheme that might be coming down the tracks for those communities.
Well, again, already some of it has happened through various agencies, but it is an additional resource allocation that will happen, again, through established community channels.
So there will be a thank you to those communities who've gone above and beyond.
Yeah, I think with government and the three party leaders met on this last week and with the relevant ministers in terms of expenditure and finance, and we did acknowledge that in certain areas, significant responses have happened and that we do need to be responsive to that and acknowledge that.
So there may be a new sports hall coming down the track, but you can't get to see your GP.
Well, I think that in terms of the health services, it's not one or the other. I think it's important that we do. I think community is very valuable. It's a very good value system in Ireland. And the community response to Ukrainians fleeing war has been extraordinary. It's been very positive. We don't often hear the positive stories, but they are out there. And I think that's something we should encourage and nurture. That's simply what I'm saying. And the government is anxious to do that.
Are you,
on the GP services, on health services more generally.
Already stretched before the war in Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But again, many people in the medical community have reached out and have been very generous in their response outside the call of duty and have come forward to help Ukrainians in situations where they require help in terms of primary mm-hmm. care needs.
Are you concerned that as the cost of living crisis bites even more over the winter, that there might be an increase in anti-immigrant sentiment in this country?
One would always be concerned about that potential, but I would say to people, we do need really to hold our nerve against Putin, because this is what Putin wants. I mean, this is his calculation, that the populations across Europe will start engaging or will start reacting negatively to their governments, creating political issues and so on like that, so as to undermine the resolve of European member states to stand with Ukraine and to stand up against the idea that a neighbour can invade another country. And because you're small as a country, you can be taken over and your democracy can be suppressed. Because this is about democracy. Putin does not like a democracy on his doorstep.
But the government has a role to play in that,
and
in safeguarding against that happening by communicating with these communities who are saying, I've 700 more people now living in my village. What is the plan? And they're not hearing anything.
Well, government will be communicating, and government will continue to communicate with communities the length and breadth of the country. But again, this war broke out in March. I would, in the overall context, I would say it's been a very strong response by Ireland. Yes, we can do things better. We can do things again and back to delivery and getting things done faster in terms of reconfiguration of buildings and rapid building and so on like that, rapid house building in terms of the medium term plan and in also in terms of services.
Okay, let's move on to the cost of
living. I just would say, apart from, I mean, one of the big innovations of the last year or two has been enhanced community care, which has been a radical transformation of the primary community care system, which can also be a very significant add-on to the GP services.
Okay, now from the recent polls, it seems that people are happy enough at the moment because that quick cash that was promised in the budget has been delivered in part. What's going to happen in the next few months when the when those handouts stop? Because I know you said at budget time we have the firepower to get through to early next year. After that, though, there seemed to be a bit of a question mark. What happens next?
Well, I mean, what I was saying very clearly then is that we would keep this under review, obviously, because there is uncertainty. And the uncertainty is because of the war and the duration of the war and also the wider global situation. I mean, most countries, and it's interesting, we were at that new European political community meeting, which is outside of the European Union, 46 states from Azerbaijan, Armenia, all of those countries who are not in the European Union. And the one major message of that is geopolitical uncertainty, both the relationship between China and it's good that there's a meeting today between President Biden and
Xi. So what's the plan here when people can't pay their bills in March?
What I'm simply saying is that we are in a better position than some countries because we're going into the next year with a surplus. But I expect that the point is global economy is going down. That impacts on us. Because we export most of what we produce. So if markets are getting depressed across the world, that will impact on us. So basically, we believe we've done enough. It doesn't fully recompense people mm-hmm. in respect of the crisis, but it's a very significant intervention by the state.
Yeah.
We will look at the situation towards the end of this winter. We plan ahead then. Because next winter will be difficult on the energy front also, in our view.
For poorer households, though, it's not that it just doesn't get them quite over the line. It's worse than that, because the ESRI said just after the budget that once those one-off payments are taken into account, because the regular welfare payments were below the forecast for inflation, they're actually going to be worse off. They're going to be poorer.
Well, we've reduced costs very significantly now, and particularly we've targeted the reduction of costs to families in particular, which needs to be factored in also in terms of reduced school costs. Next September we will have the free book scheme for primary level, which will be a significant reduction in costs for parents. We've eliminated school transport costs. And we've also reduced medical costs in terms of cost of medicines, in terms of the drug payments.
So you don't accept
threshold.
The ESRI saying that they're going to be worse off?
No, I think in terms of the ESRI, we're positive about the targeted nature of the measures we took, both in the combination of the cost of living. But the alternative was to do, in the UK, of doing an unfunded and uncosted energy system, which was some in opposition here favoured, a cap, which I think would have been worse, I think, in terms of the economy, and would not have been targeted. And I think it's a combination of targeting, helping the general population, and also reducing energy usage and energy costs consequently.
Yeah. Do you have any regrets about the universal nature of those benefits, the double child benefit, the energy interventions? I mean, we have seen last week the increase in millionaires in this country, and all those people are getting those payments from the state.
But the universality is not for the millionaires. It's about the middle income groups who are also
the millionaires are getting it,
there has to be. This is a very rapid response to a developing crisis in energy. So what we have achieved is a balance between some universal measures and some very targeted measures in terms of the social welfare payments that are going out that are substantial. And the argument around universality of child payment, benefit payments, has been around a long, long time. And many advocates in terms of for women in particular would say that it would be a regressive step to move away from the universality principle in respect of child benefit, because one never knows the different situations in different families and so forth. Now, in terms of the credit is the other major universal payment. And again, trying to get the broad, making some effort to alleviate the pressures on the broad mass of the population, I think it was also fair. Now, it does have the negative effect of millionaires benefiting from that, but that's, I think, our tax system then has to come in to deal with that.
Now, on the 30%, this proposed 30% tax rate, Pascal Donoghue has said he's examining this. Is that a priority for Fianna Fáil? What do you think about it?
Well, the priority for Fianna Fáil is to build more houses and to get more houses built. And we want to do that. And we will consistently, with the other part, our other colleagues in government, seek ways of improving our performance on housing. I have to say that, that's number one. In terms of tax, we do want to, and part of the measures to reduce pressure because of the cost of living was tax measures this year. So we did reduce tax on people. We would favour a continuing targeting of some of the tax measures.
Rather than a 30% rate.
To make sure that lower income groups are embraced by any taxation measures. But this will be examined, and of course we will examine this. And that's a joint commitment.
It doesn't
by all
sound like it's
government.
Something you're going to be pushing for, though.
Well, I think we've made a commitment that we will have this, you know, we'll have clarity on this by the autumn, by the summer's economic statement. And we want to see through the potential implications of it. We're not against it.
How concerned are you about corporation tax receipts? Because we know that they paid in bulk, really, for those one-off payments that we've just been discussing. And we see that there is a wobble now, perhaps more than a wobble in the tech sector. I mean, that income stream could fall off a cliff.
I'm very worried about it generally in the sense that... and concerned because of the one always gets concerned when there's a significant increase in any particular area of revenue.
But we can't
any
seem to predict.
Stream.
We never know how much is going to come
and
in.
I think the important point is to put significant amounts of that aside for the rainy day or for when challenges come. We're doing that, and that's important. But the revenue has been strong across the board, income tax, VAT as well. But it is a concern, and it's been flagged as a concern. And the challenges of people seeking more expenditure, seeking more alleviation in terms of revenue measures grows all of the time. And that's the political pressure on government. But equally, I would say that foreign direct investment over the last 2 years has been at record levels. And because of the fact that during COVID, Ireland and Irish companies kept production going, particularly in the life sciences, in pharma, biotech and so on. And the reaction of global companies has been very positive about the reliability of Ireland to deliver product, even at the worst of times in the middle of an impact, which didn't happen everywhere. No, I think we need to...
I suppose what we've seen over the last few weeks is they can pump the money in, pump the jobs in, they can pull back just as quickly.
Not in pharma and life sciences as much, by the way, and because that's a much more enduring... And many of the technology companies are here a long, long time. I can remember when Apple... in an earlier era, we were fighting to retain Apple in Cork. And at the time, maybe over 1,000 jobs. It's now 6,000 people working. I think in the technology sector, there's about 165,000 people working there now. 38,000. Now, this is, when you look at it in the last 2.5 years. And COVID had an impact on that. And sometimes I think we think COVID is gone, but the impact of COVID is everywhere. And it has changed the world. And we're still working through the implications of that. So many tech companies, I think, overreached, because COVID... accelerated the onset of the digitalization of economy. Zoom meetings, we all know about it. So a lot of investment, and it seems they overreached. There's a bit of, and there's right sizing going on. Now, it's very difficult for the workers in the sector. And our job as government is to reach out to the workers to say, look, how can we help you through the various government agencies, social protection, Enterprise Ireland, the various companies. And luckily, in one respect, at the moment, we're close to full employment. I think it's about 4.3% unemployment. So hopefully there will be opportunities for people in other tech companies that are growing and other announcements that are happening. So I do think we need balance and perspective in the debate around the technology sector.
OK, on the health front, we see that letter today from 70 doctors in UL saying that some patients are being left for days without being seen by a doctor. Some patients are being lost in the system. I mean, it is a complete mess. And we have a health service that costs us a fortune, but clearly doesn't work.
I think, again, we need balance and perspective in our analysis of the health service. I was at the stroke unit in Cork University Hospital on Saturday. We opened it formally. the dramatic transformation in 2.5 years in terms of how stroke is dealt in that one hospital because of the centralisation into one unit. Now we have 26 across the country. So, for example, if you look at stroke in Ireland, it's been dramatic transformation.
Yeah, that's fine.
But it never gets said.
Most people will accept that. You know? Once you're in the system, you know, it may work for you. But if you're sitting in UL and you can't get to see a doctor for days on end, that is a health system that isn't working. And you can't dispute the witness testimony of 70 doctors who signed that letter.
Well, I mean, I'll take that one more, but I do think the other side of the argument doesn't get articulated. And people say the system doesn't work in some areas and in many areas. Mm-hmm. It works in a lot of areas.
Okay, so
and I just want to make the point, this very important point.
Yeah.
The most important thing in health is that we keep our focus on strategy and a strategic focus. In heart disease, in cancer, in respect of stroke, for example, we are making big inroads in terms of survival rates and improved treatment. That needs to be acknowledged. That's all I'm simply saying. And that's over a long period of time. But in terms of emergency departments, in terms of capacity, we again have to do more. And it's not satisfactory that patients would be in that situation or that people are waiting too long in emergency departments to get access, to get treatment. Some of that is around governance in certain centres. Some of it, again, COVID has had a terrible impact in terms of the flow through hospitals because of when COVID breaks out or if there's a particular patient coming in with COVID, that means isolation practices.
Are you suggesting there's a governance problem in UL?
No, not specifically in Limerick. Just more generally, there are issues that we do need to, can we improve how we manage hospitals more effectively? That's an ongoing piece of work generally within health. And I also believe that we need to, and as I said about COVID, is a factor, but also in terms of that enhanced community care, in terms of the numbers and volumes going into emergency departments, I think a lot can be done in the community context and in the primary care context, in terms of IVs, in terms of elderly people being, in my view, being forced through A&E departments when alternatives should be, but there should be better alternatives there.
But there aren't, in many cases, they can't get to see their GP.
You know.
I mean, everyone listening to this, anyone who's tried to make an appointment with a GP in recent months will know that you're going on a waiting list. Your alternative is to go to an emergency department.
Well, I was, again, there's been a rapid expansion of enhanced community care. We have many minor injury clinics and centres as well. And in many community settings now, in terms of respiratory and so on, there are interventions that can be made which should reduce the necessity to go to emergency departments. So I'll just make that point. But that said, and again, like you mentioned in terms of the junior doctor letter and so on. I've been hearing for years about the need to reform, and within the medical profession as well, that reform also has to happen.
Okay.
And
are you going to keep Stephen Donnelly in health?
Well, I'm not going through anything to do with the cabinet reshuffle. I know you'd love me to reveal all. But
it's a bit strange, right? Because we know where Pascal Donoghue's going. We know where Michael McGrath is going. We know that Dara Brian's staying in housing. And yet health, and I know this is a priority for you, we don't know. And he clearly doesn't know because he was in the Business Post yesterday pitching to keep the job. So you mustn't have had that conversation yet.
Claire, I haven't had any conversation with any minister in respect of this because myself
Dara
and Leo...
Ryan's staying, isn't he, in housing?
Myself and Leo agreed, and Eamon Ryan, we'd wait till the end of this one. We know there's going to be lots of speculation. That's inevitable in the political world. So we're going to keep the focus on the work that we have to do now. And closer to the end of this month, beginning of December, we will then meet in terms of ensuring a smooth transition to the next phase of government.
But it's not really fair, is it, that two of your ministers, Michael McGrath and Dara O'Brien, they know what's going to happen with them on the 17th of December. And yet the other senior ministry that you have, Stephen Donnelly, he doesn't know. And we don't know who's going to be in that job.
As I said, Claire, look, you may try, but I'm not going to comment on any aspect of the transition at this stage because I think it'll just fuel ongoing speculation. Okay. The leaders will decide.
Dara O'Brien is staying in housing.
I'm not making any comment one way or the other.
Michael
McGrath
is going to be the Minister for Finance.
I'm not going to make any comment on any
Stephen
individual.
Donnelly?
I'm making no comment on any individual because we're going to do it at the end of this month in terms of how we organise a transition, which I think is important. I think we are in a very fragmented political situation now in the Dáil. This is new. It's a historic way of ensuring a government for the full term, which I really believe in, because I think that gives stability. And in economic performance, stability matters. Political mm-hmm. stability matters. We see in other jurisdictions where one has political instability, it can have very devastating consequences on the economy. That's my main objective here, is to make sure that in Ireland, through very, very tumultuous times, very difficult times, a time of war in Europe, that Ireland stays politically stable, keeps the focus on policies. The most important aspect of this government is the programme for government.
Yeah, but it must be hard.
Deliver that programme for government.
It must be hard personally to walk out the door of the Department of the Taoiseach halfway through the traditional term.
I'm philosophical about that. I don't feel it that in my bones at all. I was mentally resigned to that. So my role, I see it as leader of the Fianna Fáil party and as a party to this government, is to ensure that the programme for government is implemented, that we do make advances on the issues that you've questioned me on in terms of housing and health and climate change, which we've barely got a chance to obviously pressure. You know, these are big issues facing us. Yeah. And so I genuinely believe that the focus has to switch to substance all of the time, not just personalities. And I understand personalities are important in the political world, but that's my focus right now.
Another story on the front pages for the last week is this growing call for an inquiry into sexual abuse at the Spiriton Order. Now, you were very quick to say that you did not see a need for that. Opposition parties are calling for it. People who were victims of abuse in those places are calling for it now. And we have Louise O'Keefe, solicitor, who people will remember won that landmark case on institutional abuse, saying that the state's decision to assign provision of education to religious organisations did not and does not absolve the state from liability.
Well, first of all, I haven't said that the no to any inquiry or anything like that. And what I did say over the weekend was, I think in the first instance, in the context of the Spiritans and indeed other orders, where there are live cases and where the Gardaí are investigating cases, we have to allow that to happen and due process mm-hmm. to happen, because we don't want any potential inquiry compromise cases where people could be brought to justice under a criminal justice system.
It may not compromise it, though. Could it not happen
well,
in tandem?
It could. We will examine all of that. We will examine all of that. We will take advice on that. We've had many inquiries, unfortunately, in this country into child sexual abuse. It is sickening and shocking what has happened. I was involved in the industrial schools. I was the first minister to really bring in a major inquiry of this kind back in the late 90s in respect of industrial schools. And again, we would have to consult with people in terms of any potential inquiry here, in terms of nature of inquiry, framework, scope, and so on. These are not easy, as we've learned, situations in terms of, and the victim has to be centre stage.
But you're not ruling it out at this stage?
Oh, no, and I haven't ruled it out. But I do believe we do need to make sure that the criminal justice system should be seen to be working, because I've often made the point, because people have concerns about the length of inquiries and outcomes and so on. The existing agencies responsible must also be fully stretched and must be fully accountable also, and get the job done, so to speak.
A couple of other issues I want to ask you about. Eamon Ryan's interview in the Sunday Independent yesterday, he suggested that our five main cities could become uninhabitable as a result of climate change in time. Patrick O'Donovan, the Fine Gael Minister of State, saying that areas of this country will be underwater in the coming years. We could then have a cohort of Irish people who are displaced because of the climate crisis. Are both of those people right?
They could be. And I think what struck me when I was in Cairo at COP27 was the story of Pakistan. 135 million people affected by the floods. One third of all cropland, the crops destroyed. Mm-hmm. Massive amounts of stagnant water leading to disease. So climate change is here. And I think there's the whole effort to get emissions down. But equally, I think we need to step up on adaptation. Now, Patrick O'Donovan, the Minister, is very frustrated at the inordinate length of time it is taken through the planning system to get get flood relief schemes put in place. We know they work throughout the country, where they've happened in Fermoy and other countries, Clonmel and others, and at least they've alleviated the pressures there. But it should, I mean, there is a disproportionate thing happening where, understandably, people are objecting to various flood schemes and various purposes. People are entitled to do that. But there does come a stage when we have to balance a whole population that could be affected by major floods. And then a group saying, I'm going to take this right to the Supreme Court. I think we need to stand back and people need to assess my actions in respect of the broader population. I can remember being in Bandon twice as a leader of the opposition when all the businesses were flooded out of it. Now, the relief scheme has been built there.
Mm-hmm.
Many people would say, you should do the scheme this way or do it that way. The bottom line is, if a third flood arrived in Bandon in the same manner as the previous two, they'd all be out of business. That's the reality. So adaptation is something we're going to have to come to grips with much, much more and faster.
Okay.
And I think, Eamon was saying by the end of the century, God knows where we'll be there. But climate, mm-hmm. it's quite frightening to watch what's happening in countries right now. Sri Lanka is another country that's in peril. All the small island states in the Pacific are in peril. And it's a big worry.
Now, Taoiseach, I'm just getting some news here, which has just come into me here. And very sad news that the cervical check campaigner Vicky Phelan has died. She died in the early hours of this morning at Milford Hospital, a hospice in Limerick. And people will know that Vicky was diagnosed with cervical cancer in 2014. As I say, this news is just coming into us, and our deepest sympathies to Vicky's family and friends who are hearing this news this morning. And I'm sure you'd want to say some words and pay tribute to Vicky Phelan yourself, Taoiseach.
Absolutely. I think this is very, very sad news. I think she was a woman of extraordinary courage and integrity, who stood up for the women of Ireland, but not just the women of Ireland, but I think women globally, and to her family, to her husband and family in particular, we extend our deepest sympathies. I think in the history of this country, I think her actions, particularly in terms of not signing a confidentiality agreement at that particular time and her statement on outside the steps of the High Court, will live long in the memory as an example of someone who stood up against the system and the normal conventions of actions and so on to say, no, I'm not signing that. I want this revealed in the public interest. And she stood up for the public interest.
All right. Well, we'll hear more about Vicky Phelan after the break. But for now, Taoiseach Micheál Martin, thank you for joining us in the studio.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.